Okay, so our topic for tonight actually is not what I had posted in the email. That will be next week. The false accusations. We'll do ritual murder, the blood libel, desecration of the host. We'll save that for next week. Tonight, what I want to do is the misusing and abusing of the Talmud and rabbinic literature by the church leaders, by clerics in the Catholic Church. For a variety of purposes, although primarily for missionary purposes. So, in the 1140s, well, let's start with Pope Urban II said nothing about Jews when he called for a crusade at Clermont in 1095. So, last time we spoke about Urban II and Clermont, he didn't say anything about the Jews. The armies that reached Jerusalem were not deflected. And distracted from their primary goals by any anti-Jewish notions. And the armies of Northwestern Europe also were not distracted from their goals. They simply taxed the Jews to fund their expeditions. It was only in the Rhineland where the goon squads succumbed to their anti-Jewish prejudices and biases and killed a lot of people. The papal call was ambiguous and subject to a wide range of misunderstandings and misinterpretations. So now let's fast forward 50 years, a half a century into the future, to the Second Crusade. Well, the two leading ideologues of the Second Crusade in the 1140s were Bernard of Clairvaux and Peter the Venerable. They were pushing for conquests against the Saracens, against the Muslims, the pagans, they would call them. And both roundly rejected any call to anti-Jewish violence being fomented by populist gangs. And just as in the case of the First Crusade, there were these populist gangs who wanted to kill Jews, so too in the Second Crusade, there was talk about it, there was scuttlebutt, but the leading ideologues did not want that to happen. They wanted to do whatever they could to protect physical safety of the Jews of Northern and Western Europe. But these two figures, Bernard and Peter the Venerable, were diametrically opposed in their assessment of the quality and character of contemporary Jews. And we're going to examine what do they actually think about Jews? They don't want them to get killed, but what do they really think about them? So Bernard of Clairvaux was determined to quash any outburst of violence that the likes of which had happened half a century earlier. He believed that 12th century Jewry's dispersion and subjugation were a fulfillment of biblical prophecy. You know, the Jews are at the bottom of the heap. They're suffering. They're dispersed all over the world and they have no power. And that's God's will. That's right out of the Bible. That's what God wanted. Then he said like this, whereas the Muslims have begun to attack us, the Jews have accepted their dolorous state and don't cause any trouble. Jews have the good grace to accept their subjugation and don't pose any harm to Christians. So basically, the Muslims are, you know, militarily significant and politically significant on the world stage, and they attack Christians in the Byzantine Empire, in the Eastern Roman Empire, and even in the West. Okay? So therefore, it is appropriate for Christendom to use its military muscle against the Islamic world. By contrast, the Jews are doing nothing. They're a bunch of schleppers. They're a sorry bunch who are at the bottom of the heap, and they're not causing any trouble. So we don't have to cause any trouble for them. Moreover, to kill Jews during the Crusades, Bernard would think, would deny them the possibility of salvation. Because if you kill them while they're still Jewish, before they've become Meshumadim, before they have apostatized to Christianity, then they will not be saved. And we want to save their souls. We don't want them to die as a Jew. We want them to die as a Christian, but peacefully in their beds when they're old. We want to win them over by whatever means we can, but not to kill them. Now, the existence of living Jews, in his view, was a useful reminder to Christians of the crucified Christ. So, you know, we want to remember Yashka, so therefore you need to have these Jews because that'll remind you of it. Bernard believed it to be a wise Christian policy to adopt nonviolence to all non-Christians who accept their lowly state. Now, aside from Jews, who else is there who's not Christian, who's accepting their lowly state? I don't know. Maybe, you know, some heretics or some, you know, oddballs somewhere in the world. But basically, if you're not a Christian, but you're acknowledging that the Christians are dominant and regnant, then we're not going to, you know, harm you in any physical fashion. We'll adopt nonviolence. Yes, the Jews did wrong in rejecting Jesus, he would say, but their bad deeds are partially balanced out by the earlier glorious history of ancient Israel. And I remember last couple of weeks, we've been saying that the history of ancient Israel is something that the church has to figure out what they want to do with. On the one hand, they're respectful of the Old Testament, at least the Catholic perspective, as opposed to the Manichaean perspective. Ancient Israel once had a covenant with God. So does that mean that the Jews of today get some slack? We give them a pass because their ancestors were wonderful or were nice or had a covenant with God? So Bernard is saying, that's a feather in their cap, that their ancestors had a covenant with God and were a glorious people. Like Paul and like Augustine, Bernard believed all Israel will be saved. What is the Jewish version of that? All Israel will be saved. What's the Jewish version of that? Unmute yourself.
I think all good people have a place in the world to come.
What's the exact citation?
Sorry.
Kol Yisrael, Yesh Lahem, Chelek, Lalam Haba. Good, good. So that's the Jewish way. Kol Yisrael, Yesh Lahem, Haba. But the Goyish Izach here is that in the view of Bernard and some of his predecessors for 1,000 years, all Israel will be saved ultimately. He had an optimistic view about the prospects of their future conversion. Also, in his view, you don't harm the Jews because of divine fiat. You know, God makes the rules in this world. And Psalm 59 says, do not kill them. Even if they might have committed deicide, still, God doesn't want them to be killed. And Jews' continued existence is a reminder, a constant reminder to Christians of Jesus' suffering on the cross. So, moreover, Jews introduced monotheism to the world and affected a humanizing of a barbaric world. All these things are reasons to be favorable to the Jews. Also, the Jews are the biological kinsmen of Jesus. He was a Jew in the flesh. So his third cousins are alive today. How can it be bad to them? All this works in their favor. That was Bernard of Clairvaux. Now let's go to Peter the Venerable. So he had a totally different approach. He believed that 12th century Jews were consumed with animosity and hatred for Christians. So whereas Bernard said, they're not causing any trouble. They live at the bottom rung of society. They're not doing anything wrong. No, Peter said they're causing the trouble every day in every way with their hatred in their heart for Christendom. Okay. Now, whereas Bernard wrote for a wide audience, telling them to protect the Jews and not to harm them during the crusade, Peter was writing exclusively to the King of France, to Louis VII, and telling him to offer physical security to the Jews, but to tax them as a funding mechanism for the crusade. So I'll read to you along these lines the following. Now, Bernard, Peter doesn't like Jews. It's clear that although he's saying don't hurt them, he doesn't like them. So I'll read to you one little paragraph. But what value in pursuing and attacking the enemies of the Christian faith in remote and distant lands, while the Jews, wretched blasphemers, far worse than the Saracens, not far away but in our midst, so freely and audaciously blaspheme, abuse, and trample on Christ and on Christian sacraments with impunity? In what way does the zeal for God consume the sons of God if the Jews, the worst enemies of Christians, escape unaffected? So this reminds me of what was being said in 1096. You know, why traipse off to the Middle East to kill Muslims when you have Jews right here who are even worse than them? And we're leaving them unmolested. So the follow-up to that argument is, okay, so cut their throats and kill them all. And yet that's not what he says. So he sounds like Emiko of Leiningen of 1096, but in fact holds back. He says, it would make sense to do them harm, but we're not actually going to call for that. So for Peter, Muslims, in the chat, would you want to see something? One second, hold off. A recurrent ancient burning Judas in effigy. Right, so that's going to be a thing next week when we discuss, Asher, for next week we're going to discuss desecration of the host and ritual murder and all these things. physical things that Jews are accused of doing. As for Norman, however, Jesus was an accepted prophet according to the Muslims. That's exactly the point. We're going to get to that right now, that the Muslims accepted Jesus as a prophet. Okay, so for Peter, Muslims are less reprehensible than Jews because Muslims at least accept a few Christian doctrines like the virgin birth. So in some regards, the Muslims have adopted Christian perspectives. The Jews are worse, not because they killed Jesus, but because they reject all Christian doctrines, meaning we have our own Ikarim, Ikare Emunah. We believe whatever we believe in. And all the Mishigas that was invented later, we don't subscribe to at all. Whereas Islam, because it comes third on the scene, accepts at least partially some of the Mishigas of Christianity. So that's a feather in their cap as far as Peter the Venerable is concerned. Now, for Peter, the problem is not the ancient past of Jerusalem. He's not obsessing over what happened in the year 30 outside the gates of Jerusalem. But rather, in the 12th century, in the present, Jews profane Christian sancta and trample upon their beliefs and display abusive behavior. Ongoing aggressive behavior and blaspheming of Christ. So for Bernard, the Jews are totally outside of the rubric of the crusade. But for Peter, the Jews shouldn't be killed, but they're really terrible. So because they're really terrible, what you do, make them pay for the whole thing. Take Jewish money. Jewish money. Okay, that's the idea. Now, Bernard balances the good and the bad, whereas Peter only has negative things to say. And I'll read to you again another section from Peter. Yeah. Quote, "I do not say these things so that I might sharpen the royal or Christian sword against the next of these execrable Jews, since I bear in mind that it is said concerning them in the divine psalm, with the prophet saying the following in the spirit of God, God will show me victorious over my enemies. Do not kill them, lest my people be unmindful. Indeed, God does not wish that they be killed or destroyed entirely. Rather, for the purpose of greater torment and ignominy, he wishes that they be preserved for a life worse than death." A life worse than death. Okay? So, and the rest, I don't have to read. The point is, he's saying, I'm bad-mouthing these Jews. But you should know, I'm not bad-mouthing so that anybody will kill them. Now, the reality, of course, is that if enough people hear this, if a rabble, if a crowd of thousands of people are being fed preachy stuff about how horrible the Jews are, that they deserve a life worse than death, then they're not going to have a life at all. They're going to get bumped off. And so for all the talk that this is not designed to sharpen any swords, Lamaisa, as we would say, it sharpened the swords. Okay? Well, he claims, Peter, that he's just trying to spur a Christian king to nonviolent action, nonviolent anti-Jewish action. Since we can't physically hurt them, we'll hurt them economically. Jews should be forced to contribute their ill-gotten gains to the sacred military endeavor. Now, this business of ill-gotten gains, what does that remind you of in later history, more recent times?
Lending money at high interest, isn't it?
Okay, so in medieval times, yes, usury, high interest. But I'm thinking a certain word in the Nazi era, but even before the Nazi era, since Wilhelm Marr, modern anti-Semitism, there's a certain word I have in mind. The Jews are leeches. They're leeching off society. That whatever they have isn't rightfully theirs. Whatever they got at the expense of the Christian population. So everything they have are ill-gotten gains. And so, since it's ill-gotten gains, we'll take it back from them in the purpose of crusading against the Muslims. So it's a win-win. We strip the Jews of what they shouldn't really have, and we use those funds to commit holy war against another bad group, the Muslims. Okay. Now, King Louis of France did not take Peter's advice, and ultimately the Jews were not despoiled of their treasures, and they did not fund the Second Crusade. Peter wrote another work against the inveterate obtuseness of the Jews, convinced of their unceasing enmity towards Christendom. Now, Augustine's goal was to convince the Jews of biblically grounded truth, and he thought in the end he would be successful. Peter, the Venerable, 800 years later, has no ideas about that future. He doesn't think the Jews really are going to be convinced by any of this stuff. So why do you bother with all the rhetoric? Why bother with any of this? The answer is just to pummel them even further, with no expectation that from a missionary perspective, it's actually going to have any effect. So he doesn't see an eventual reconciliation between God and biological Israel. Instead, he just projects anger and annoyance at the fact that the Jews won't see the light. They just won't see the darn light. Peter sees their current obtuseness as a mere extension of their historical obtuseness throughout the centuries. He's just besmirching them for its own sake. Now, why does Peter have a different attitude than Paul did, or for that matter, Augustine, or for that matter, Luther? Norman is mentioning Luther. The early Luther believed he could win over the Jews. When he didn't, he got really nasty. Yeah. So, but why is Peter the Venerable taking this anti-Pauline approach and saying, they're never going to convert anyway? Why?
Realism.
Realism, good. Because 1,000 years passed and nothing happened. You know, if you try again and again and again, it doesn't work. Go into Shelfen, it's not going to work. So whereas in the 4th century or maybe the 5th century, an earlier church father might have had this rosy picture of what, you know, from their perspective of what the Jews will eventually come to believe, by the Second Crusade, it's unlikely, highly unlikely. Okay. And anyway, Christendom was getting angry and impatient. Impatient. It's taking too long. Okay. So, a second, it's just a little noisy. Let me just mute everybody. Okay. So, Peter's innovation is that he cites and attacks the Talmud. In the 12th century, Jews begin to know a little bit more about the New Testament, and Christians begin to know a little bit more about the Talmud. Each side's secondary literature, meaning the primary literature is the Old Testament, the Tanakh, the Chamisha Chumshei Torah, the Rabbim Ksuvim. What's the secondary literature? For the Christians, it's the New Testament. For the Jews, it's the Torah Shebaal Peh, the Talmud, the Oral Law. And in the earlier centuries, neither side really had a good working knowledge of the other side's secondary literature. But by now, there's a greater awareness. They've been living together for enough time that they picked up on these nuances. So we don't really know how Peter came to know this information about the Talmud. Probably from an ex-Jew, from a Mishumad, who had some Talmudic training and fed him all this, you know, derogatory information. But he wasn't citing the Talmud to convert anybody, merely to convict the Jews with their own words. The Jewish failure to accept Christian truths made them less than human. Give me a line from the Davening that says that if a person doesn't know basic truths, does not understand, they're less than human. Where in the davening? I'll give you a hint. It's not in the daily davening. It's only in a house of mourning. Who can quote me the line? It's the last line of davening at Shacharis in a house of mourning. Beis Avil. Adam bikar velo yavin nimshal kabehemot nidmu. Mourner's Kaddish. Okay? If you don't understand, you're like the beasts of the field. So the Jews, they should have seen the obviousness of Christian truths based upon the Old Testament, and they don't. So therefore what? They're like the beast of the field. They're subhuman. Now, subhuman is a word we're going to find later in the modern period, but it has its antecedents. Okay, here. Now, he also cites Isaiah chapter 6. To prove that Jews have been rejecting true prophets, real prophets, Navi Emes, not Navi Sheker, for as far back as 2,000 years, and that their obtuseness is, you know, ingrained in them, and you can't get it out of them. They're incorrigible. They will automatically reject the truth, no matter what century they are living in. And I'll read to you one last citation from Peter. Okay. I shall lead forth that monstrous beast from its lair, and shall exhibit it in the view of all the world, and in the sight of all the peoples to be ridiculed. I shall present before all, O Jewish beast, that book of yours, your book, the Talmud of yours, that reprehensible doctrine of yours, which you prefer to the prophetic books, to all the attention to authentic teachings. Meaning, the Bible is authentic, the Old Testament, the Tanakh, and you guys prefer the Babylonian Talmud. By the way, he's not wrong. In the sense that educationally, pedagogically, where is the emphasis in Jewish learning? It's not on the Hebrew Bible, at least not today it isn't, and it hasn't been for a few hundred years, at least not in Ashkenaz. Ashkenazic Jews, even the ones who are educated in yeshiva, are complete ignorant fools when it comes to the Bible. Your average yeshiva kid can't quote Habakkuk or Zephaniah if your life depended on it. but they can quote Baba Basra very easily. Okay, so he's right that there's a preference in Jewish learning for the Talmud over the Bible. Well, for Peter, the Talmud has three major shortcomings. One, it is demeaning and even blasphemous in its depiction of God. Two, it offers a ridiculous portrayal of the afterlife. And three, it evinces low moral standards. Peter sees the Talmud as muddled and misguided, and therefore the Jews themselves as muddled and misguided. Now, in the generations to follow, the negative perceptions offered by Peter the Venerable would intensify and strike root in the minds of Christians. The practical consequence of all this, which Peter himself might have rejected, was physical violence. It inevitably followed. So in the chat, Norman's mentioning Pablo Cristiani and the Ramban. We're going to get to that in the next few minutes. So Peter had an unusually high amount of Talmudic knowledge for a goy, for a Christian cleric of the 1140s. Still, it was limited. You know, he knew enough to write something, but he wasn't a Talmud Chacham. And he only used it to further denigrate his Jewish contemporaries. Over the next century, between the 1140s and let's say the 1250s or 1260s, the number of Jewish converts to Christianity with substantial Talmudic training multiplied. And so now among the Christians, among the Notzrim, you'll have a lot of people who can cite Gemara and Mishnah and Brisa and Medrash with fluency. And they would also utilize this knowledge in new directions, not just to denigrate Jews, but for other purposes, maybe proselytizing purposes, missionary purposes. The first activist of this sort was Nicholas Donen. Yeah. We don't know much about his biography. There are certain details we are pretty confident in. One of them is that the rabbis of La Rochelle excommunicated him for his beliefs in 1225. 796 years ago. And I promise you that the rabbis of New Rochelle have not similarly done anything of recent years. Okay? Now, he was probably a Jew from Southern Europe who converted and settled in Paris. He argued to the church leadership that the Talmud was worse than silly. It was literally intolerable in the sense that it ought not to be tolerated in Christian Europe. So intolerable in a very literal sense, like you shouldn't have it around anymore. Get rid of it by means of destruction. In 1235, he composed a letter for Pope Gregory IX to send to all the Christian monarchs of Europe, detailing 35 accusations against the Talmud. They fall into six broad categories, and I'll give you the six categories. One, power allocated to the rabbis, that the Talmud gives the rabbis too much ecclesiastical juridical power that they're going to abuse, and that if the Christians knew about this, they'd be upset by it. Secondly, number two, anti-Christian behavior sanctioned by the Talmud, that there are certain practical behaviors, not just abstract theological beliefs, but practical behaviors that are hostile to Christianity. Three, antisocial behaviors committed by the Talmud. So whereas number two was anti-Christian, this is just generally speaking like low class, antisocial. Number four, Talmudic material that demeans God, whether a neutral third party would think that it demeaned God or only in the eyes of a Christian cleric, I couldn't really tell you, but the way Donen is reading the Talmud, there are things that are demeaning to God. Number five, teachings that demean Jesus and the church. And lastly, statements that are utterly ridiculous and ludicrous. The last category are the types of things that Peter the Venerable was talking about. You know, things that just make the Talmud look stupid. Then he said, contains matter that is so abusive and so unspeakable that it arouses shame in those who mention it and horror in those who hear it. Well, having done Daf Yomi cycle almost two times now, I can tell you that there are parts of the Talmud that are a little bit difficult to say in a mixed audience. There are things you'd rather the outside world not read. And there are certain things that even the inside world of internal Jewish constituency might be discomforted by. Every now and then there's a stray passage that says something like that. But hear donors saying there's a whole lot of it. It's disgraceful. So the Pope waited 3 years until 1239 before acting on Donan's request. And then what happened? The Pope sent out messages to kings all over Europe to confiscate all copies of the Talmud and hand them over to the churchmen for investigation, specifically the Dominican and Franciscan friars in Paris. And what was going to happen? If they were to find errors in the books would be burned at the stake. No, Ba'esh Tisareth, burned at the stake. The order of confiscation actually was only carried out at that time in northern France under the auspices of King Louis IX. And the Talmud was put on trial and ultimately was burned several times in the 1240s. But at Paris, at the Paris trial in 1240, Nicholas Donan squared off against Rabbi Yechiel of Paris and the Sarmi Kuzi, Rabbi Moses of Kuzi. What were some of the things that Donan cited from the Talmud to show how utterly horrible it is? So there were those things that he knew would antagonize a Christian audience or any non-Jewish audience because it creates a divide between the Jew and the other, with the Jew being the elite, with a godly covenant, divine covenant, and the other being out of that covenant and treated unfairly, harshly. So one of the things he cites is Ger Sheshavat Chayav Mita. What does that mean? Ger Sheshavat. No, Nochri Sheshavat Chayav Mita. Nochri, a non-Jew who rests on the Sabbath, is deserving of the death penalty. That why? Because the Shabbos is Oti, okay, Beni Uben Bnei Yisrael Oti Liolam. It's a covenant, it's a sign of the covenant between God and Israel. Only between God and Israel. As we say in davening on Shabbos morning, God didn't give it to the heathens of the world. Only Yisrael amchanatatel bi'ahava, to Israel alone with love. So a nochri who rests is liable for the death penalty. Now this is a very interesting concept because you know, it never says that in the Torah that a goy that goes you know Saturday without working is in any kind of trouble. So this is a rabbinic embellishment. Why was this rabbinic embellishment created? Well, to protect the integrity of the Jewish Shabbos, as opposed to making it a universal thing. It's supposed to be ours alone, so we don't want other people taking it over. In fact, reality is that many other religions did adopt a weekly day of rest, whether it's you know the Sunday Sabbath for the you know, the Lord's Day in Christianity, or the Islamic Friday, which is not exactly the same thing, but along the same lines. So, yeah, that's what the rabbi said. Also, a nochri she'osek ba'Torah chayav mita. If a non-Jew engages in Torah study, they're deserving of the death penalty. Why? Because the Torah is the rightful property only of Israel. Lo asa chen lechol goy mishpatim bal yedaum. Hallelujah. We say every day in davening that the mishpatim, the statutes of God, were given to Israel, not given to everyone. And Bali Daum, they're not supposed to know it. Hillel's asking in the Kiddush, it states you are to rest you, your animal, and your Ger B'Sharecha. Right. So the Ger B'Sharecha refers to the Ger Toshav, or possibly the Ger Tzedek, but not to the complete stranger, the complete outsider who has no bearing on Jewish society. so these are some of the things that Donan knew would strike a chord. Another thing that he cited was that after the Churban, Mishacharav Beis HaMikdash, after the destruction of the temple, Ein LaKadosh Baruch Hu BeOlamo, God has nothing in this world, Ella, except for Dalid Amot Shel, what's the next word? Who knows? Dalid Amot Shel Halacha. That after the destruction of the temple, God only has in this world the four cubits of Halacha. Now, if you're a student of the yeshiva and a devotee of the Shulchan Aruch and you like studying Jewish law, then fine. To you, the idea that God's concerns in this world are exclusively whether the Jews abide by the halacha and study the halacha, it makes sense. It's your theology. Okay, good. But if you're not a Jew and you don't like Judaism, that's going to sound very narrow. and demeaning towards God. The idea that God has nothing in this world other than the four amos of halacha, as though, you know, the works of physics and chemistry and biology don't matter, but some hyper-commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, the Shach and the Taz is all that God cares about. So if you're a goy, this sounds like blasphemy or absurdity. Okay? Now, so ultimately then, Donan is successful. And you know, the rabbis tried to respond to these comments by noting that there are mitzvot in the Torah and recorded in the Talmud where there's equitable treatment of Jews and Gentiles. And they tried to say that whatever Donan was citing can be counterbalanced by other agadic statements in the Talmud. The Talmud is a vast corpus of knowledge, and you could cherry pick a source here or there to make it look bad or look good, but that Donan's arguments are not the be-all and end-all. So they tried their best, Yechiel of Paris and Sami Kutzi, but they were not successful. Ultimately, the Talmud was burned. So in June of 1242, more than 24 wagonfuls of manuscripts, 10,000 volumes overall, were destroyed. And the Talmud became symbolic of everything that the Christians feared of the Jews. Now, Norman is asking, wasn't this partially the result of the anti-Rambam faction? So the answer is, you know, that on Tisha B'Av, if you look in the footnotes of the Yad Scroll Machzor, and the other Machzorim too, they'll mention in the Kina about the destruction of the Talmud that, yes, that the Rabbeinu Yonah of Jerundi, he did an Al-Chet Shechatati Lefanecha, that he had led the charge to burn copies of the Rambam's Mishnah Torah and Mor Nevuchim. And as punishment, the divine punishment for the anti-Rambam activities, anti-Maimonidean activities of a decade earlier, the Jewish people were punished with the destruction of our sacred books. So it's not as though they instigated anything. It's that they regarded this as well-deserved punishment imposed by the Ribono Shel Olam for their past misdeeds. Okay. Now, so in 1244, Pope Innocent IV commended the French king for his actions. But then in 1247, the Pope reversed himself. So first he said, yeah, it's good to burn the Talmud. Then he said, well, it's not so good to burn the Talmud. Why did he change his mind? Why would a Pope reverse course on something like this? Well, the answer is he was approached by French rabbis who said that without copies of the Talmud, Judaism cannot survive. Practical Judaism cannot survive without Talmudic learning and Talmudic treatises physically available to us. And this would undercut the Augustinian doctrine of tolerating Jewish life within Christendom. So here the rabbis were arguing to the Pope that you, Pope, have an Augustinian doctrine that has to allow Judaism to survive. Well, we can't without our Talmud. So therefore, stop burning it. And the Pope bought into that line of argumentation and said, fine, no more burning. Well, what's the solution, though? If the Talmud really does contain objectionable sections, how do you deal with it without destroying it? So the answer is censorship. That, yes, in France, it became the norm. It remained the norm to burn copies of the Talmud. But in other parts of Europe, the solution was the censor, the censorship of the offending passage, but retaining the rest of the text. Okay. Now, Donan introduced evidence that the rabbis had arrogated to themselves way too much religious authority, that they demeaned sacred books of the Bible, and led their followers into grievous error. Donan lent new substance to Peter's old charges that the Jews were guilty of ongoing blasphemy. So if you think the Talmud, which is being studied day after day in the academies of the rabbis, contains these offensive passages, blasphemous passages, then yes, it's not only the Jews of yesteryear who committed some blasphemous act in the days of Yashka, but even today, Ad Hayom Hazeh, he would argue that the Jews are committing blasphemy. Were the censors Christian clerics or rabbis, as Joanna is asking? And the answer is they were Christian clerics. However, every so often, there would be a passage that the rabbis themselves thought might be a little bit too risky. And there is an occasional self-censorship. This self-censorship would continue all the way up until modern times. Even in the Tsarist Empire, you look in the Aruch HaShulchan, there's occasional self-censorship because you don't want to offend the guys who have the guns. Okay. Now, Donan substantiated the most negative allegations against the Jews, past and present, with careful citations from the sources. And this was a major milestone in the projection of negative imagery of the Jews. But Donin was not the greatest of them all. He was just probably the first of the ones who had real Talmudic training. The next one we'll go to is Pablo Cristiani. So Pablo was a Meshumad, and he used his knowledge of Jewish sources for an entirely different purpose, namely proselytizing. That whereas Donin's goal was destroy the Talmud, pummel the Jews, you know, really stick it to them, Cristiani wanted to convert people. Like Paul and Augustine and an early Martin Luther, Pablo harbored genuine hopes for convincing Jews of Christian truth if they were confronted with evidence from their own religious tradition. So this is a new strategy. It's a chidush. You want Jews to convert to Christianity? So show them that the Talmud itself and the Midrashim actually are proof texts for Christian truth, not for Jewish truth. How do you like that? Well, that requires a lot of manipulating of the text and a lot of knowledge of text. If you don't know this stuff, you can't do this. You have to really be, you know, having something in this encyclopedic knowledge to get this done. So which passage is he going to harp on? Well, he posited that rabbinic exegesis of key biblical verses could surprisingly strengthen the Christian case. For example, the suffering servant of Isaiah 52, 53. The church says it refers to Jesus. The Jews say it refers to Am Yisrael in its totality. At the disputation of Barcelona, the Bikuach HaRamban, here you have Cristiani duking it out with Rabbi Moses ben Nachman, the Ramban, the leader of Spanish Jewry. If this were a course on medieval Jewish history, I would spend a whole session or more on that disputation, on the Vikuach. But I want to focus only on the anti-Semitism angle. And so just for our purposes, we can say that each side, after the fact, wrote a treatise describing what happened, each side claiming glorious success. But the sort of the neutral academics of the last 100 years will say that the bottom line is that they both could point to some minor victories, but neither side had a resounding success and didn't totally defeat the other. The Ramban would argue because his hand was tied behind his back and that it was an unfair fight and that the ground rules favored the religious majority. And I don't doubt that. But there was no clear winner. Well, by the middle of the 13th century, it was no longer only former Jews who supplied the church with Hebraists and Talmudists. Even real Goyim, not just Mishumadim, apostate Jews, but even real born Gentiles began studying these subjects in advanced academies, not for the sake of getting a doctorate or an academic position, but for the sake of some religious agenda. They're studying the other guy's literature to use it against them, to advance your own religious cause. So in this spirit, Friar Raymond Martin, or Raimundo Martini, from Catalonia, circa the 1250s to the 1270s, wrote Pugio Fidei, which is translated as the dagger of Christians for slaying the perfidy of the impious, especially the Jews. That's a mouthful. But basically, he wrote a book of tremendous erudition to try to prove the point that Christianity is the real religion, and that even the Jewish sources, the rabbinic sources, would concur if read correctly. The sheer volume of his citations was quite impressive. Raymond knew more than Peter, Donin, or Pablo combined. Was he a born Jew who converted out? Some people say yes. It's not entirely clear whether Raymond Martin was born a Gentile or was a Sephardic Mishumen. We don't really, really know. Okay. Well, he had tremendous knowledge, but there's one little caveat. There are certain citations of the Midrash, especially Bereishis Rabbah, that he quotes, though we don't have that in our Bereishis Rabbah. So some said he fabricated material. Hey, when you're trying to win an argument based upon somebody else's literature, and it's kind of an arcane literature that not that many people know, you could probably get away with faking it. Who's going to know? But years and years later, we do know that we don't have this. So some thought he was a charlatan who was faking it. But Leopold Sunz, the great granddaddy of Wissenschaft des Judentum, of the scientific study of Judaism, said, no, he didn't forge anything. He really had that material, but we've lost elements of the Midrash over time. And actually, we are indebted to him for preserving stuff that we as Jews didn't preserve. And these things happen sometimes. Louis Ginzburg was an expert at this sort of thing. Louis Ginzburg in Legends of the Jews, written 120 years ago, published by JPS. So his expertise in his doctoral dissertation was on Midrashim that are preserved in the writings of the church fathers, but that we don't have from our own internal literature. So it did happen. Okay. Now, what does Raymond Martin have to say to us? So he was convinced that Jews can be won over if you use their material in a compelling fashion. And Genesis 49:10 was a favorite of his. Last week's Parsha, Parshas Vayechi, Lo Yasur Shevet Miyudah Mechokek Miben Raglav, Ad Ki Yavo Shiloh, that the scepter and the legislator shall not part from Judah, from the tribe of Judah, Ad Ki Yavo Shiloh, until Shiloh cometh. Until Shiloh cometh. Now, what is Shiloh? Ad Ki Yavo Shiloh. So, from the Christian point of view, there's no doubt about it. Shiloh is Jesus. That there shall be Judahite rule over the Jews until the advent of the messianic arrival of Jesus, and then there no longer will be any Judahite supremacy. Of course, Jesus himself is going to, they're going to assert about him Judahite ancestry, that he is of the Davidic line and worthy of being a king of the Jews. But the point here is that it all comes to an end. That's the last one, and there's no more. So in the Vikuach, the Ramban and Pablo also addressed this point, and each side tried to win some points against their fellow. It's worth it for us tonight just to go through the history of ancient Israel and of Rabbinic era Judaism to try to see when was there or was there not leadership that claimed Davidic or Judahite descent. So first of all, you have the Davidic dynasty, the monarchy, the United Monarchy in the days of David and Solomon, and then the Southern Kingdom from the days of Rehavam, Rehoboam, all the way until the last king in the days of Nebuchadnezzar. So for 400 years, you have Davidite kings. So yeah, fine, there's the scepter is in Judah's hands. But then the Babylonian captivity, 70 years where the scepter is not in Judah's hands. Then Zerubbabel, who is the great-grandson of the last Judahite king. So yes, the Shevet Yehuda once again has some authority over the community, but it lasts one generation. And afterwards, leadership of the community in Eretz Yisrael is in the hands of Ezra, Nehemiah, the high priests under the Persian period and the Hellenistic period, followed by the Hasmonean dynasty, which is a Kohanic dynasty, followed by Herodians, which are quasi-Jewish Idumean types, and then Roman rule. But you do have the restoration of Judahite and supposedly Davidite leadership in Eretz Yisrael and in Babel. Who am I referring to? The Nasi, the patriarchate of the house of Gamliel, the house of Judah HaNasi, that was from the days of Gamliel the second of Yavne, all the way through Gamliel the sixth in the year 425, was the ethnarch of the Jews. So for internal Jewish purposes, there was a Davidite on the throne. It wasn't a real throne, but he was the boss of the Jews of Eretz Israel. Now, the truth of the matter is, we don't really know if, as a matter of historical fact, the Gamlielian dynasty was really a Davidite dynasty. They claimed it, but it might have not really been true. I shouldn't be accused of blasphemy for saying this. I wrote an article about this a number of years ago, but it's a commonly accepted notion in the scholarship that their assertions of Davidic descent were dubious. Okay, but what about the Exilarch in Babylonia? So the Exilarch is also claiming Davidic descent, and that probably is true. That's more likely to be real Emes. Okay, so from a Christian point of view, this is very, very much an inconvenient truth. The Christians would say that after the year 30 and the death of Jesus, there's no more any example in the world of Judahite supremacy within Judaism. But in fact, there was for another 1,000 years. So that's the counter argument against Pablo and against Raymond Martin. Okay. But Raymond Martin has another argument to justify the assertion based upon Jewish sources that the scepter and the legislator is stripped from the Jews after the time of Jesus. And what does he refer to? Well, let me ask you a question. Capital punishment in Judaism is a common thing, commonly in the Bible, but not so commonly put into practice. The Talmud says, you know, it was infrequent, once every 7 years, once every 70 years, and the rabbis didn't like the death penalty. Okay, the rabbis were pretty much liberal compared to a more rough and tumble Bible. But when does the Talmud say that the Jews lost the authority over capital punishment? When? Who knows? Come on, there are 60 people. Somebody's got to know this.
Beis HaMikdash destroyed?
Before that. How many years before that? What's a nice round number in Judaism?
40.
Bingo. Good job, Norman. Okay, 40 years before the Churban, the Gemara says that the Sanhedrin left the Lishkas HaGazis, the Chamber of the Hewn Stone, and they no longer were able to handle capital cases. Now, some would argue the Romans stripped them of that ability, that the procurators, you know, said, no, it's in our hands, not your hands. And some would say it's a spiritual thing that the Sanhedrin did it of their own accord. Doesn't matter. The point is, 40 years before the Churban, the Jews lost authority over capital punishment. When did Jesus die? How many years before the Churban? Around the year 30. So Raymond Martin is saying, yeah, with the demise of Jesus, that's the end of serious Jewish authority over their own people. Okay, and what about Mechokek, the legislator? So he cites the Gemara, what Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava. What's the story with Yehuda ben Bava? What did he do, Yehuda ben Bava? Come on, we learn this in Yom Kippur and Tisha B'Av every year in the footnotes. Come on, guys.
He gave smicha.
Correct, Tina. Very good. Okay, you win the prize for tonight. So, what Raymond Martin is trying to say is that there are no real rabbis anymore because smicha ended. That Hadrian prohibited smicha and would destroy a city if you were found giving smicha in that city, and so it's the end of the real rabbinate. And that the Ramban is not a real rabbi. He's just a scholar of Judaism. But the real rabbinate is over. Now, as a truly historical matter, he's wrong. Because the smicha did continue through Yehuda ben Bava and their disciples. And arguably, it continued even until Gaonic times. You have the literature of the Gaonim saying that if you're in Bavel and you want to have your case adjudicated of Dinei Knasot, matters of Torah fines, you have to go to Eretz Yisrael to find truly ordained judges, musmachim, and that they still existed in the post-Talmudic era. Okay, but as far as Raymond Martin is concerned, no, the real rabbinate came to an end. Hadrian destroyed it, and it was right after Jesus' time. So Genesis 49:10 really does refer to Yeshua Notzmi. Okay. Now, Pablo cited rabbinic sources to prove the conditional nature of divine assurances. That Israelite sins were sufficiently weighty to undo God's promise blessing of unending settlement in Eretz Israel. That we're supposed to be in Israel forever, but we're not. Why? Because our sin is that terrible. The severing of the divine relationship. The 10 tribes, and the Gemara says, Nirushami, the 10 tribes of the northern kingdom, the Aseret HaShvatim, have no portion in the world to come, Ein Lahem Chelek L'Olam Haba, and they're not going to return. Lo Yashuvu L'Eretz Israel. They're not coming back to Israel. Rabbi Akiva cited the pasuk, Kayom Hazeh, as this day, that just as this day comes and goes and never returns, that tomorrow is a new day, but not the same day over again, so too the lost tribes are lost forever. They're not coming back. So if the idea is that the tribes of Israel can be lost forever, then Raymond Martin is saying that's not only true about the lost tribes of the northern kingdom, it can be true about Jews generally speaking. All of Jewry can be lost in terms of the divine covenant. They're never coming back. Okay? So Raymond draws on this material to show the devastating nature of Israelite sin and the all-embracing and everlasting quality of punishment, that actually, in abandoning their faith, the Israelites had themselves become Gentiles. How do you like that? That the Jews are really Goyim, and the Christ-believing Goyim are really Israel. So the Jews are now Gentiles. Okay, v'na'apohu. Raymond compared the breakup of the United Monarchy of Solomon into a heathen north and a loyal south with the breakup predicted by Daniel between errant Jews and truth-embracing Christians. This is an interesting idea, that just as the Malchut Yisrael of David and Shlomo becomes the north of Yisrael, the south of Yehuda, and the north is idolatrous and bad, and the south is religious, you know, traditional and good, so too the breakup later on between the church and the synagogue, the church is good and the synagogue bad. Okay, so the two idolatrous calves that were set up by Yeravam ben Nevat at Beit El and Dan are compared to the two false messiahs of early Common Era Judaism. What are the two false messiahs of early Common Era Judaism? The two major rebellions against Rome. The War of 66 to 70, which led to the destruction of the Temple, and the War of 132 to 135, the rebellion of Beitar. That as far as Raymond is concerned, these are false messiahs. That the Jews think that they can defeat the Roman Empire, that they can regain their sovereignty, their control over their own destiny. No, it's a false hope. They could not do it. Why? Because they've been rejected by God. So the two rebellions against Rome, he said, were each led by a Bar Kozba. Now that's baloney. The second one was led by Bar Kochba, or by Bar Kuzba, whatever, whether that's a fake name or a real name. Nobody really knows his real name. But the first one was certainly not led by a Bar Kozba. But here Raymond is saying they're both led by a false messiah. Then he says, Akiva was a martyr to the devil, not to God. And that Raymond turned what was traditionally a laudatory act of martyrdom into a repulsive service of the devil. Akiva was a deceiver and a deceiving supporter of false messianism. Raymond turns his martyrdom into idolatry. Raymond likens the northern kingdom, the rabbinic Jews are like the northern kingdom, forever rejected because of gross theological error. Okay, so Raymond asks, what sin was it that caused the destruction of the temple and the expulsion of the Jews from Jerusalem? So what does the Talmud say about why the second temple was destroyed? Sinas chinam, good. So Raymond interprets this to mean baseless hatred, not of each other, but of whom? Of Jesus. So who was rejected and persecuted by the Jews. And then he has an interesting argument, which, by the way, in my view, is by far the most compelling argument that he makes in the whole book. He says, listen, First Temple Jews are, according to the Talmud, guilty of three cardinal sins. Avodah Zarah, Gilui Arayos, Shpichas Damim, idolatry, murder, sexual violations, the big three cardinal sins. By contrast, the Second Temple Jews kept Torah and mitzvahs. They studied Torah, they did mitzvahs, good. And yet, the first exile was of short duration and of known duration, meaning they were aware ahead of time it was going to be 70 years, as opposed to the second exile, which is a very long duration. It's interminable, and we have no idea when it's going to end. We were not told when it's going to end. It's torturous. So why is it that the second exile is worse than the first one if the behaviors of the First Temple Jews was worse than the Second Temple Jews? It must be that the sinas chinam that we're talking about here was really super duper bad. Not just, I don't get along with my neighbor. It had to be even worse than the cardinal sins. So what possibly could it be? What could be worse than a cardinal sin that is in the realm of sinas chinam? The answer is the Jews killed God. Deicide. And that's why the sinas chinam led to such a horrible outcome. If it was just the guy doesn't get along with his neighbor, so not the end of the world. A little punishment, but they killed God. Therefore, a very great punishment. So that's how he uses the Talmudic material about the reasons for the Churban to show why it is that the second exile is more severe. Okay. Now, Christian familiarity with the Talmud, with this we'll close this last little piece. Christian familiarity with the Talmud might have led to an amelioration of Christian perspectives on the Jewish past, present and future. Meaning, you have Goyim learning Judaic studies, they come to have a soft spot in their heart, the Jews. You know, there are plenty of Goyim who major in Jewish studies in college, become professors of rabbinic literature, and they convert to Judaism, okay? Because they develop a liking for the whole thing. But that actually didn't happen. In fact, in the 12th century, 13th century, things just got worse. The negative imagery became more entrenched. Raymond's innovation was his utilization of a whole new set of literary sources. His history was unreservedly negative. unlike Bernard from a half hour ago, who was a mixed bag and said nice things about the Jews, Raymond Martin had nothing nice to say about the Jews. So the question then is, this is a very serious question, was it productive or counterproductive? If he was trying to convert people, but he has nothing nice to say, and only the most horrible invective, is that going to turn people off? And if a Jew is listening, what are they going to think of all this? The guy hates my guts, so I'm not going to convert to his religion. So it could be, could very well be that all this is counterproductive to what he supposedly is trying to accomplish, and that of making more proselytes to Christianity. So likely, such denigration was going to alienate whatever Jew was listening to all this. Now, in fact, the book was not written for Jews to read. It was written for Dominican missionaries to read. And it surely deepened the animosity and antipathy of those missionaries, those friars, towards their Jewish targets. So yeah, ostensibly they were still trying to convert people, but really they were just being riled up and their passions were inflamed to hate even more. And so conversionary pressure didn't work all that well, at least not of this sort. The, you know, I'll kill you unless you convert. That occasionally has efficacy. Of course, it's an insincere conversion, but it works sometimes, as opposed to hitting them over the head with Talmudic citations, which hardly is going to have much effect. Okay, I'll take a few questions.
Just wanted to point out that on Zoom, take a look at the BBC. There was a production of the...
I've seen it, yeah.
Also, the others may want to know about it.
Yeah, it's available on YouTube, the Disputation.
Disputation, okay.
Anybody else?
I have a question.
Take it away, Tina.
I heard that the Pashtuns in Afghanistan...
are from the 10 Lost Tribes.
Yeah.
Well, if you look at them without the beard, they could pass for an Ashkenazic Jew. It's true. With the nose and the facial features of the Pashtun Afghanis, they do look like us. I mean, it's a stereotype, but I'll admit there's a...
Well, how did
it's not all that ridiculous.
How did they get that notion?
I don't know. I mean, the Lost Tribes went east. How far east can you go before you fall into the ocean?
The Navajos.
I don't know.
The Lost Tribe went south and merged with Judea.
Okay, so correct. So we've had that discussion before. That it's clear that there were those from the northern tribes who went south. And the Gemara talks about how there were elements of all 12 tribes in the southern kingdom. And that has halakhic ramification for the ability to observe Yovel and Shemitah and this sort of thing that requires Yisrael b'Yishuvan, Israel settled in its land.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, all right, folks, see you next week.
Thank you.
Next week we'll do ritual murder, blood libel, and the like. So stay tuned. Yeah. We'll be back in person, God willing, in Woodmere next week.
Let me invite more people to come.
Please, folks, if you're in the five towns, please come in person. We'd love to have you. Okay, guys, take care.